Welcome to Deeper Questions. Submerge in wonder, surface with hope. My name is Aaron Johnstone, and we're back after a decent hiatus, and we're trying to return with a bang by covering the US election. We're asking the question, will democracy survive 2024? And to help us think it through, we have David French from the New York Times.
How will Trump make faith great again? Nobody can explain that, but there's a sense that he has to win to defend the faith. And that is a very dangerous emotional tie between Christianity and politics.
2024 has been an incredibly historic year for democracy around the world, with over 4 billion people, so over half the population, having voted or looking forward to voting in various elections. More people than ever before. Now, not all of these are legitimately democratic countries, of course. Many of them ran or are running sham elections, such as Russia, with Vladimir Putin, who of course had his opposition jailed and then killed. Not exactly a fair and free process. And a reminder that elections and our leaders matter significantly. There are also important elections in the UK and throughout Europe, but one country will likely overshadow all of them. The US election on November 5th this year, 2024. Everyone will be watching, everyone will have an opinion, and no one knows what will happen. The unconventional Donald J. Trump is looking to return to power after a wild 4 years at the top. He's now a recently convicted felon, was twice impeached, and has three other criminal indictments awaiting trial. He's probably been the most talked about and polarizing figure of the last 9 years, and yet he has a serious chance of reclaiming the Oval Office, with his formidable base of loyal supporters seemingly unswayed, if not more enthusiastic, as Trump's legal troubles have stacked up. As things stand currently, he'll face off against 81-year-old incumbent President Joe Biden again for a 2020 rematch, who has had a relatively strong first term, but is in a world of trouble now. The conversation in this episode was recorded before the presidential debate, which just took place in late June, and oh man, what a cataclysmic disaster for the Democrats and the Biden campaign. Joe Biden's age was already a pothole that was threatening to become a sinkhole, but his performance in the first debate has just become an earth-splitting chasm that threatens to swallow the Democratic Party and the entire presidential race. The Democrats are in full freak-out mode and are encouraging him to step down with only a few months before the general election, which was already going to be chaotic and tense. Why do an episode on this? Well, the first reason is that I felt compelled. Personally, I follow politics closely, and as the son of an American with family over there, I feel somewhat invested for a range of reasons. I'm on Team Democracy, and I, like many, have huge concerns for what the MAGA, or Make America Great Again movement, represents, and what another Trump term would mean for the world. Not many thought this could be happening in America, and a similar situation could easily happen in Australia too, if we're not careful. And increasingly, there are similar forces at work in many parts of the world, who are mobilising and becoming more and more successful and coordinated. So I wanted to spend some time thinking about this movement in the American context before their election. I also want to show another side of Christianity for those who associate it with an aggressive, reactive form of political conservatism. Christianity has many different voices, and so I wanted to talk with someone that I deeply respect and who I think our listeners will appreciate if they haven't heard him before. I'll also add that my views aren't necessarily representative of all views within my organisation. I've been given trust and confidence to wade into controversial and divisive topics and to call it as I see it. We know not everyone will agree, but I've done my best to handle it carefully and hope you find it helpful. David French is a columnist for the New York Times. He joined in 2023 after co-founding The Dispatch in 2017 and previously wrote for the National Review. Prior to that, he was a practicing lawyer, specializing in First Amendment cases and freedom of speech. He was also deployed in Iraq in 2007 and was awarded a Bronze Star for his military service. He is a conservative voice for the politically homeless after being unceremoniously dumped and disowned from Republicanism when he signaled his opposition to Trump and became a face of the Never Trump movement. He lives in deep red America in Tennessee, a state that overwhelmingly voted for Trump in the 2016 and 2020 elections. He understands American evangelicalism because for most of his life, he would have happily called himself one. He's a thoughtful Christian voice and someone I've admired from a distance for a long time. And I think he's just about the perfect guide for the US election, if such a thing is possible. An absolute honor to have you on the show, David French. Thanks for joining us on Deeper Questions.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We have to start with your idea of the Nerd Olympics. So you write on your New York Times bio that if there were a Nerd Olympics, you might take the gold medal. Do you have an all-time favorite kind of crowning glory nerd champion moment? Something that cemented your nerd legacy?
Well, you know, when you have a nerd career as long and as glorious as mine, it's very hard to pick your just greatest nerd moment. But there is one that stands out, and it is the premiere of Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, which was, you know, I had been waiting for a great film adaptation of Lord of the Rings for my whole life. And then Peter Jackson does it. It's glorious. So for the third one, my wife and I both dressed up to attend the premiere.
Good.
So she dressed as Arwen. I dressed as a Nazgul in a costume so convincing that the ticket taker wanted me to remove my cowl just to make sure I was okay. It was so I had to show them my real face and all of that. This was, you know, 20 plus years ago, and we're waiting in this very long line to get into the theater. And the theater decided to host a Lord of the Rings trivia contest. And the winner received an actual frame from the movie, sort of a framed actual frame of the movie. And I, you know, I don't like to brag, but I mean, that trivia contest was a piece of absolute cake. Although it is to my shame that I not only won the contest, they just kept asking me questions to keep going to see when they could stump me. And they did stump me because I could only name two of the three elven rings.
Right.
And I was embarrassed and humiliated that I couldn't go three for three. But overall, I won that title. And so I guess, you know, in that long and glorious nerd career, that's my highlight.
Okay, that's pretty good. So we should add to your bio, lawyer, veteran, writer for the Fourth Estate, elite athlete.
Right. Winner of Lord of the Rings trivia contest. Yes.
So let's talk about your pre-journalism days. You studied at Harvard, studied law, and mm-hmm. started your career as a lawyer and spent much of your time defending freedom of speech. What attracted you to the law, and why did you stop practicing as well?
Yeah. You know, what attracted me to the law is actually a pretty dry and mundane reality, which was I was graduating college with a political science degree in undergrad and didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And if you graduate with a political science degree, it's not as if there's a giant amount of career options for you as an undergrad coming out of a small Christian college in Tennessee with a political science degree. So I needed to go to graduate school, and I looked at law school as an option expanding choice. There's no history of legal practice in my family. I didn't feel any particular call to the practice of law. I just didn't know what I wanted to do in my life. And I thought that going to law school would give me new choices. And so I went to law school just really out of kind of no better option. And then as soon as I got there, I found out, oh, this is great. I love this. I'm so glad I made this choice.
Yeah. So nerded out on that instead.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, if you want to talk about Nerd Olympic training centers, that's
it's up there.
Law schools and law students.
Wonderful. Moving into your journalism career. So you started at the National Review, but then pivoted pretty significantly during the 2015 election season, famously coming out against Donald Trump as the prospective Republican nominee, mm-hmm. and then leaving the National Review to help found the Dispatch a bit later.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about your political journey?
Yeah. Well, you know, my political journey is actually very, very closely related to my journalistic journey. I had started writing well before I became a full-time journalist. I had started writing an awful lot for various publications because I had practiced constitutional law, First Amendment law, free speech law, and that always got considerable press attention, the cases. The constitutional cases in the U.S. almost always get press attention. Mm. And I began to be frustrated with the way the press covered my cases. And so I began a habit of writing about my cases and submitting these pieces for publication. And it began to reach a point where by early 2015, I was writing a lot and really enjoying it. And so I reached out to Rich Lowry, then the editor of National Review, where I had been placing a lot of pieces, and asked him if he'd be interested in me doing more. And he was incredibly gracious, and he said he was just thinking of reaching out to me to ask me to do more. And so we started working together at National Review. I became a staff writer at National Review. And this was a key time because when I joined National Review, I was coming out into National Review as a conservative movement lawyer. So my role, if you were going to place me in sort of the ideological spectrum in the United States, I'm a very conservative member of what we called the conservative legal movement. And this was a coalition of attorneys and organizations who litigated with very direct constitutional objectives, protecting free speech, protecting religious freedom, overturning Roe v. Wade. And we had very specific objectives. And I was at that time what you would call a conservative in good standing with both the conservative NGO world, like the conservative activist world, and also the conservative political world. I was a proud Republican, quite conservative. So I joined National Review in May of 2015. The very next month, Donald Trump comes down the escalator to announce his candidacy. And at first, I didn't take it seriously. Very, very few people did. I mean, that was an obvious mistake on my part not to take it seriously. It's a mistake that was not unique to me, but it's still a mistake. But as he was rising in prominence and rising in the polls, I got very alarmed relatively quickly and did not see him as compatible with either the conservatism I grew up with or the Republican Party that I grew up with. And began sounding the alarm, not initially saying, I will never under any circumstances vote for Trump, initially saying he should just lose the primary. And then as it became clear he was going to win the primary, then I became outspoken saying nobody should, even if you're Republican, even if he wins the primary, you shouldn't support it. I became what part of what we call the Never Trump movement.
Yeah.
And to say that that was a earthquake that altered my sort of place in the political world is an understatement. I mean, a personal earthquake. It was the MAGA movement is not tolerant of dissent internally. It is definitely not tolerant of dissent within the GOP. It is not tolerant of dissent within the conservative movement. And so I publicly declared in 2016 that I was not a Republican any longer. I could not belong to a political party that would put a person of such low character at the top of the ticket. And then when I did this, people began to try to sort of essentially excommunicate me from the conservative movement more broadly.
Yeah.
And so while I retained my conservative views, I found myself subject to, you know, for an excommunication is kind of the right word, an effort to purge me from this movement and to try to get to turn people against me, to not listen to what I wrote, to accuse me of being some sort of traitor.
Oh, wow.
The language in conservatism is they call people who are, would call me a squish or a rhino, which is a term for Republican in name only. Hmm. And I would respond, I'm not a rhino. I'm not even a Republican in name at all anymore.
Yeah.
But I retained my conservative convictions. And so it was a very difficult time for those conservatives who dissented from Donald Trump's rise. And we found ourselves really quite homeless because the Democratic Party wasn't wanting to embrace us. The Republican Party was actively rejecting us. It was and is an extremely disconcerting experience.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Because, yeah, obviously there was quite a personal cost that came with it. And you've done a lot of reflection about this over the years as well.
Yeah,
I remember you writing recently an article saying never Trumpers never had a chance.
Yes.
Which I'll link in the show notes. Could you explain a bit about the takeover of the Republican Party?
Yeah.
And what it looks like now?
Well, you know, a political party is an engine for winning elections. It can be an ideological engine as well. It can be an engine for advancing ideas. It's primarily an engine for winning elections, but it can and should be an engine for advancing ideas and policies and values. And so I had always seen the Republican Party, the modern Republican Party, the Republican Party of my youth and sort of growing up as centered around sort of three core ideas. Now, there's room for debate within each one of these ideas, but centered around three core ideas that I broadly agreed with. Core idea number one, and I mention it first because Reagan, this comes out of sort of Ronald Reagan's ideology and sort of around that time period. Core idea number one was strong national security. Now, why would I say this number one? Because this Reaganism arose during the height of the Cold War. And so in many ways, every election during the Cold War always had American national security as issue one or issue 1B. It was always very high in the mix. And so the one of the core elements of the sort of the Reagan conservatism was America should be involved, forward deployed military forces, tight and close military alliances, and that the combination of American strength and American alliances maintain peace and deterrence. So that was point number one. Point number two was what you would call economic conservatism in the way that it was meant at the time, which meant less government intervention to try to control economic outcomes. So the Reagan conservative mindset was very influenced economically by books such as Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom, which are extremely skeptical of the ability of central planning over complex systems. Yep. And so the idea was that America suffered from an excess of central planning. It's not that there was no room for any planning, but that an excess of central planning, and we needed to pull back from that. And the final prong was for what we in the United States call just social conservatism. In other words, sort of a conservatism that protected religious freedom, that defended the rights of unborn children. And so as those were considered the three legs of the Republican stool.
Yeah.
Now, Donald Trump, he knocks out to different degrees all three legs. So on national security, he is much more what we call an isolationist. He wants to pull back from American military commitments, even to the point of potentially withdrawing from NATO, which would be catastrophic. Mm. He has a very negative view about American forward deployment, especially in Europe. He would abandon Ukraine, for example, something that wouldn't just cause Ronald Reagan to roll over in his grave. It might cause him to just go ahead and jump out to try to stop something like that. It's unthinkable in classic Republicanism to show weakness in the face of Russian aggression. Unthinkable. And then when it comes to the economy, he is a central planner in many ways, in the sense that he believes in big government intervention to do what he wants economically. He's a big spender. The deficit went up every year of his presidency. And then when it comes to social conservatism, yes, on the one hand, he appointed justices who actually helped overturn Roe versus Wade. But the man is a disaster from a social conservative standpoint. Three marriages, cheated on his third wife while right after the birth of their child with a porn star to whom he paid hush money. He's just a personal character disaster on every front. And so for somebody like me looking at this person rising, there was no argument really for me that could appeal to me for him because all of the key ideological elements that I valued in a leader, he did not possess. And also all of the personal character that I think is indispensable in a leader, he did not possess. So I couldn't, it was very difficult for me to see why I should support him, and I did not.
So one of the striking things about Trump's takeover has been the complicity and the cheerleading from large swathes of the religious right.
Right.
And two of the respective terms that have been used to kind of rationalize and understand this alliance is Christian nationalism for mm-hmm. evangelicals, and then Catholic integralism for Roman Catholics. So could you walk us through those a bit, elaborate what these two concepts are?
Yeah.
And then maybe could you give us a sense as well of how widespread they are at a grassroots level, like yeah. local church context?
Well, it's very interesting that we would be talking about Christian nationalism or Catholic integralism in the context of a Donald Trump era when he is so thoroughly secular. In many ways, you would say, why are we talking about Christian nationalism when Donald Trump is so thoroughly secular and he is the standard bearer for the Republican Party? Well, the answer is the Christian nationalists and Catholic integralists see him in many ways as almost an empty vessel into which they can pour their and effectuate their ideology. That Trump gravitates towards his allies by wrapping both arms around Donald Trump. They can gain an immense amount of influence and power and reach. And so there's all of a sudden this very live discussion about how much, it's in essence, how much Christian authoritarianism should come into public policy. Okay, so what is Christian nationalism? What is Catholic integralism? It is very important to get these definitions right. So Christian nationalism and Catholic integralism are not Christians participating in politics and bringing their values into the public square. That's not Christian nationalism. Everyone brings their values into the public square. Yeah. And for those people who think that, say, Christians should not, well, I would ask, you know, thinking again, keeping in the American context, the abolitionist movement. I think people historically admire the abolitionist movement in the United States a great deal. And yet this was something that was very deeply rooted in Christian moral values, not exclusively. Abolitionists were not exclusively Christian, but very deeply rooted in Christian moral values. The civil rights movement. Martin Luther King was a Baptist pastor. He made religious arguments in public square. So Christian nationalism is not Christian participation. What Christian nationalism are and Catholic integralism are markers of Christian primacy or Christian supremacy. And so the Christian nationalists would make Christianity the official religion of the United States, for example, or a Christian nationalist would say that Christians should rule. It's a version of what you might call Christian identity politics. And one element of that is this concept called Seven Mountain Dominionism that essentially splits up culture into seven mountains of influence, like media, government, education, the family, etc. And the argument is that Christians should rule all the seven mountains of cultural influence. So this is Christians should rule, Christianity should reign supreme. That's Christian nationalism. And the reason why I separate out Catholic integralism is Catholic integralism is like Christian nationalism, except it's very much connected to the Catholic Church and the authority of the Catholic Church and integrating the power of the state and the authority of the Catholic Church. And so that has some distinctions to it because of Catholicism's sort of universal presence around the world. It's not as, quote, nationalistic as pure Christian nationalism, which is more of a Protestant exercise, at least here in the United States. And it's rooted in mainly Presbyterian and, surprisingly, given the history, some Baptist traditions. And it really does have kind of one of two and sometimes two of two prongs, which is Christians should have formal legal supremacy is one prong, and Christians should rule is the other. And then there's this other kind of more amorphous concept of Christian nationalism, which isn't so much ideological or identity-based as it's emotional. There's this sense of I feel that there is a deep connection between the fate of the nation and the fate of the church. And so you'll often hear this or see this. The historian Thomas Kidd from Baylor University had a great illustration where he said he was driving or passed by a sign in 2020 and it said, Trump 2020, make faith great again. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an emotional appeal. How will Trump make faith great again? Nobody can explain that, but there's this sense that he has to win to defend the faith. And that's not really ideological. It's not really identity politics. It's a more of this deep emotional felt need for political victory for spiritual success. And that is a very dangerous emotional tie between Christianity and politics.
Yeah. Okay. And do you feel like this is widespread in churches or just snippets?
Yeah. It's very tough to measure how widespread it is. So, you know, you can measure it in a number of different ways by some polling questions. But the way that I would put it is that it is disproportionately popular amongst some of the most engaged Christian activists. So you can have something that is not terribly widespread in absolute numbers. A Brookings 2023 PRRI Brookings Christian Nationalism Survey found that only about 10% of the population is really truly Christian nationalist in the U.S. Now, that's 30 million people, but that's only 10%. But then what if that 10% was disproportionately engaged in political activism? Then they're going to punch way above their weight. And you see this in any organization. I don't know if in Australia you guys talk about an 80-20 rule in churches.
Yeah.
20% of the people do 80% of the work.
Yeah.
Well, if that's the case, the 20% who do 80% of the work have more influence than the 80%. So with Christian nationalism in the U.S., you have a lot, you don't have as many Christian nationalists, but they are very vocal, they're very active, and they are very engaged. So they punch way above their weight. They are much more influential than the numbers would indicate.
Hmm. Okay. And connected with this conversation, I guess, there's a debate that you had with a guy, Sohrab Ahmari,
right.
where you got an ism named after you, David French-ism.
Yes.
And a lot of that conversation, from what I gather, is about the tone of the church.
Yes.
And so it's gone in two very different directions, hasn't it? So could you explain that a bit as well?
Yeah. So it's not every day that your name becomes an ism. And it's a double-edged sword, I got to say, because what if people don't like the ism? Then it can get very ugly for you. But Sorbo Mari wrote a piece called Against David Frenchism in 2019, and it essentially had two elements to it. One was that the times were so urgent that values like civility and decency were of secondary importance. The culture war should be fought with real aggression, and that civility and decency, if they interfere with the ability to fight the culture war with real aggression, they are, quote, second-order values. Hmm. The other part was that the other side, the left, was so aggressive that the traditional protections and civil liberties inherent to liberal democracy have to be shoved aside. And that the classical liberal American founding that places a premium on individual liberty was in many ways profoundly flawed. And so in this urgent time, again, this is the Amari argument, in this urgent time of confronting a hostile left, Christians should abandon both decency and classical liberalism, American small L liberalism. So Frenchism, and I became a symbol of the defense of classical liberalism through civility and decency. And so
it's a good ism.
I'll own that. I mean, I think actually that's too complimentary of me. I'm not as nice as he framed it. You know, I've been a litigator most of my career. I've always been kind of a combatant in the battle of ideas. And so it was really funny to hear some friends sent me notes saying, why is Sorbo Mari calling you like that nice? You're not. But I became a kind of unearned symbol of the defense of classical liberalism, which I have always defended quite vigorously through civility and decency. And so ever since that attack, a big part of my work, because Sorbo Mari wasn't just speaking for himself, he was speaking for a growing right-wing movement. A lot of my work is the defense of liberal democracy, small L liberal democracy, and the defense of civility and decency and kindness in the public square, which I'm very happy to do this. I did not have this on my bingo card that one of the defining characteristics of my career would be defending the American founding, but that's where we are, and the debate continues.
Let's go back to some of the root causes of some of this stuff. So in 2020, right around the thick of the kind of election season, you published your book, Divided We Fall. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible book for the moment that it came out. And it's just as relevant now, if not more so. But you start out the book talking about things like polarization, negative partisanship, mm-hmm. and this huge kind of political sort that has taken shape over the US over a number of decades.
Yeah.
Could you maybe walk us through a bit how this shift has happened and what it means?
Yeah, absolutely. So the book was called Divided We Fall, America's Secession Threat and How to Restore Our Nation. And I was very nervous when we decided on the subtitle of America's Secession Threat, because that's a big word, secession. And a lot of people, you don't want to be alarmist, but I was legitimately alarmed that we could face a disruptive political crisis. And so I wrote it in 2020, and a lot of people raised their eyebrows and said, okay, I know we're divided, but that divided? Then January 6, 2021 rolls around and a mob storms the Capitol to try to overturn the results of the election. And the people are saying, oh, okay, we get it now. We see why you were so worried. But the reason why I was worried was not, and if you read the book, it is not a Donald Trump is bad book. My point was that Donald Trump was landing in a culture that had been separating for decades. Hmm. And that all of the cultural trends were pulling us apart more than they're pushing us together. Every important cultural trend. So for example, America has been in the processes of something called the Big Sort. And what is the Big Sort? The Big Sort is a term coined by Bill Bishop in a book a couple of decades ago, where he noted that Americans are more likely to live only around like-minded Americans. In other words, you live in ideological bubbles more than in years past. We are living in increasingly less ideologically diverse communities. Liberals live with liberals, conservatives live with conservatives. And in fact, that is a trend he identified that's just gotten worse. So virtually every election since Clinton's first election, the percentage of Americans who live in what are called landslide counties, these are counties where one side or another wins by 20 points or more, just keeps going up. There might have been an exception or two in those various election cycles, but it is just we are clustering more and more into like-minded enclaves. Now, there are a lot of reasons why people do that. It's kind of more fun to be around people. You know, people feel more relaxed when they're around people they agree with. And especially as political tensions heat up, when people disagree with you, it can get tense. So there's a lot of reasons people like to raise children around others who share their values. Makes a ton of sense. But there's a dark side to it. And the dark side was outlined by Cass Sunstein in 1999 in a paper called The Law of Group Polarization. And what he did is he collected a ton of research that shows that when people of like mind gather, they tend to become steadily more extreme. And so what ends up happening is these like-minded communities are becoming extremist at large scale. So it used to be that American politics, like politics in many nations, was a bell curve. You had your right and your left, edges were pretty small, and a big middle, a big, big middle. But now the bell curve is flattening. So there are more and more people on either edge. It's still the case that the middle is bigger than the edges, but it's flattening. And so we're clustered together, we're becoming more extreme. And then the other formula here is grievance. So as we cluster together and grow more extreme, political combat gets sharper, angrier, and more toxic. What ends up happening is you not only begin to argue about policy, what's your tax policy? Those are manageable arguments. Even abortion and policy arguments are manageable arguments. You can have the discussion, vote, or have a judicial ruling, abide by the outcome. But what we're coming up with now is something much more like what I saw when I was serving in Iraq in 07. What I saw between Sunni and Shia was not a policy disagreement, but was volcanic rage created by a sense of injury. And so in Iraq, it was the Shia would say, well, why am I fighting the Shia? They killed my cousin. Or a Sunni a citizen would say, why am I, you know, and vice versa. The Sunni killed my cousin, the Shia killed my uncle. And there were these things actually occurred, these atrocities actually occurred. And it was fueling the conflict much more than the ancient theological differences between the two strains of Islam. Come back to America, and I began to notice a similar dynamic. It's not that we were so angry at each other over public policy as much we began to be angry at each other over what the other side has done to me. And so the judicial wars in America are a perfect example. I'm furious because the Republicans blocked the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. That's a grievance. And then the next Republican would say, why are you furious about that? We're furious that 20 years ago you blocked Edmund Bork from coming to the Supreme Court. And then we'd say, we're even more mad at you because you lodged unfair charges against Brett Kavanaugh. And you go back and forth. And then now the grievances are starting to be violence. Far left, you know, engaged in rioting in 2020, and conservatives are very angry about that. The far right stormed the Capitol in 2021, and the left is very angry about that. And so you begin to have this concept of mutual grievances that emotionally are more important to people than the policy disagreements. And so you add all of that together, and you have a recipe for division, for hatred, and as we've been seeing, for violence.
Yeah. And one thing you get with that as well is like the sense of proportion in these things just get, like gets worse and worse. There's a false equivalency with a lot of these cases where they're not treated with the proper respect that they deserve. And instead, they just fuel it over and over again.
Absolutely. And then, you know, what ends up happening is as you're polarized and you're in your bubbles and you're becoming more extreme, then even your news intake begins to reflect your preferences. And so if you're on the left and you hate people on the right, the algorithm is going to start to reflect and feed you the information that you interact with the most. And so you'll get fed a steady stream of true stories about people on the right who are acting terribly. And if you're on the right, it's sometimes true, sometimes false, but let's just say true stories. People on the right get the algorithms feed them true stories about people what on the left do. That would be bad enough, right? That would be bad enough if your news diet and your algorithmic diet was true bad things about your opponents. But now that's really being buttressed and supplemented by false bad things.
Yeah.
And so the one constant is you're getting fed bad information about your opponents. Some of it's true, some of it's false. It's very difficult for people to discern the true from the false, but all of it inflames. And so what ends up happening is you have people who just utterly have a distorted view of the other side. And this has been surveyed. This isn't just me. There was a group called More in Common, which did a really important survey on American attitudes called the Perception Gap. And what it found is that partisans, and especially those who consume a lot of media, have totally wrong views of their opponents. Both right and left think their opponents are more extreme than they really are. And the only people who really get it right are the people who just don't pay much attention to politics at all on the media. And that's because they get all of their information about their political opponents from these, you know, antiquated things called friendships. So they learn about people in real world, not in the online world, and they have a more grounded view of their fellow citizens. It is interesting that the most disengaged Americans, or the more disengaged cohort, has the more grounded view of the political views of their opponents than the most engaged cohort.
I imagine they're generally happier and healthier and all these sorts of things too.
Oh, yeah. Reminds me of a guy who told me, and I wrote about this recently, who said, you know, I turned off cable news, or I switched it from, you know, Fox to ESPN, deleted all my social media, all of it. And he said, I'm a better husband. I'm a better father. My blood pressure is lower. A lot of people are just kind of tuning out completely, which is its own problem. That's good for them. It's good for them. But if they're reasonable people and people of real values, bad for us that they're disengaging.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's come back to January 6th. Obviously, that was a highly significant moment and a bit of a turning point. And something that kind of dovetails it nicely there is that I was finishing off your book, and the very day that happened, the storming of the Capitol, it happened that day, and I was finishing off your book, and got to the end of it. There was a renewed sense of urgency shortly when I got through it. So.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, very timely.
I was getting text messages all day saying, okay, you were right, this is more dangerous than I thought it was.
Yeah.
I was saying, I don't want to be right.
No.
I don't want it to be this fragile and violent.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us more about that. Tell us about the shadow of January 6th and what it meant at the time and what it kind of means in the lead up to this election.
So, you know, what it meant at the time and what it means is really, there are really two different answers to that, depending on which American community you belong to. So, on the day of January 6th, it was actually pretty remarkable the extent to which the Republican community was already minimizing it. And so on the day, even though this was absolutely undoubtedly a MAGA crowd storming the Capitol, we were watching the violence with our own eyes already, like during the actual event, you began to see the first hints of the conspiracy theory that it was all actually far left activists doing it, or that this was what's called a Fedsurrection. In other words, it was instigated by undercover federal law enforcement agents. So you already began to see the denial. And then you also began to see the minimization. So on the one hand, they were saying the violence, terrible violence, any of that was Antifa, but it was mostly peaceful. So you began to see the minimization on the right. In the left and in much of the middle, it was a seismic shock. It was, I cannot believe what I am seeing. And it took time to sort of absorb the magnitude of it. And to this day, the sort of the ongoing legacy of January 6th is bifurcated just like that. That the Republicans after January 6th, they didn't reject Donald Trump. They rejected Mike Pence and Mitch McConnell. That's who they rejected. So McConnell and Pence stood up to Trump on January 6th, and they stuck with Trump, and they rejected Pence and McConnell. There's this very chilling graph of public opinion that shows that on January 6th, Trump had a slight decline, part of a sort of a longer term slight decline of Republican approval. But Pence and McConnell fell off a cliff.
Wow.
Republicans just were angry at them. And that has really illustrated our national divide very effectively. And so since January 6th, you kind of have a big community of Americans who either minimize it, blame the other side, or get very angry when it's brought up. Because they say January 6th was nothing compared to the riots in the cities of 2020. Or January 6th was necessary because they were just protesting a stolen election. You get this. So the Republican side has, in many ways, this might surprise some people, has reconciled itself more to January 6th than it had on January 7th, on January 8th. It just grows more comfortable with it every passing month. Now, in the rest of the country, for those people who are engaged in politics, you know, a lot of people have checked out. For those people who are engaged, there's just this sense of unbelievable disbelief that it occurred, anger that it occurred, and disbelief that it is continuing to be rationalized. And by so many Americans, I think we could understand if a very small percentage of Americans still rationalized it. But to have so many Americans minimize it is pretty shocking and demonstrates the extent to which, you know, Americans often live in almost, it's almost like they live in two separate worlds.
Yeah. So let's zoom into the election season stuff now, do a bit of forecasting. So let's start with the bleak. Should Trump get reelected, what should we expect in a second term? So could you outline it from a domestic perspective as well as a geopolitical perspective as well?
Yeah. You know, it's actually harder to outline what a second term will be like from a domestic policy perspective than you might think, because Trump is so erratic. What we do know is that, and he has pledged it as many times as he possibly can, is he'll pursue vengeance against his political opponents. Now, in the United States, that's harder to do than you might think. We have layers upon layers of constitutional protections. And in many ways, punitive actions against his opponents may serve mainly to make them rich by inflicting legal harms on them that they can vindicate in court, that they can receive compensation for in court. But he would pursue vengeance. He's going to stack his administration with sycophants and toadies, not with experts in people of character. And then to the extent that we know his ideology, we know a couple of things. One is he's always going to do what's best for Donald Trump. And number two is he seems to have pretty much figured out that he thinks that America needs to be much less involved in the world stage. And so he has indicated that he would cut off aid to Ukraine, abandon Ukraine in a moment of real need, of extraordinary need, of increasing need. He has more than hinted that he might want to back out of NATO. He has proven, you know, even before the last couple of weeks, a lot of his defenders would say, no, you're misunderstanding. He is not actually capitulating to dictators. He just has prioritized differently. And he believes Europe can handle Russia and it takes us to handle China. And he's always been a China hawk. Well, then he went and flip-flopped on whether or not we should ban TikTok in the United States unless TikTok divests from its Chinese ownership. And why did he do that? Well, you know, we can't look inside of his heart, but we can tell you that there is a time linkage between supporting TikTok and the intervention of a Republican mega billionaire who has, it turns out, helped him out of a financial jam related to his fraud judgments in the U.S. And so that's a real problem. But even if he's not actually for sale, the fact that he is so erratic means that you don't actually know what he's going to believe will be in his self-interest in any given moment. But based on what he said, we also could be looking at a potential immediate invocation of the Insurrection Act. Now, this is extremely dangerous law that's on the books in the U.S. that allows the president on his own discretion to call out active duty troops or to what we call in the U.S. nationalize state troops, the National Guard, nationalize the National Guard, and use them, deploy them to American towns, cities, and communities to suppress protests or unlawful activity. This is an extremely dangerous law. It has not been exercised and used very much by previous presidents because previous presidents, thankfully, have mainly cared about the Constitution. But it's a law that gives, it's a poorly drafted law that allows him on his own, on his sole judgment, to call out the troops and use them internally in the United States. And so a number of his advisors urged him to use it when he, during the 2020 riots. They urged him to use it during the election contest or when he's trying to steal the election. Plans are being drawn out to use it on day one of a new Trump administration. And then the other thing, he is also, in my view, as a conservative and a former member of the conservative legal movement, the best thing that he did as a president was he appointed a lot of what I thought were very good and effective classical liberal judges to courts at all levels. Well, he has repented of that. He now does not think that the judges that he appointed were radical enough. Why? Because they mostly ruled against him when he tried to steal the election, or almost exclusively ruled against him. And so he is now vowing to nominate, you know, a different kind of judge, and you would expect him to nominate a different kind of judge. And so you're talking about more authoritarian judges. You're talking about attempted authoritarian acts of vengeance and punishment in the U.S., potential invocation of the Insurrection Act, potential abandonment of NATO, potential collapse of Ukraine, potential capitulation in the face of Chinese interests. Other than that, it all looks great.
Yeah. Well, let's spend some time breaking down the candidates. We'll start with Trump, but we'll talk about Biden as well. So
sure.
Let's start with Trump. Why might Trump lose, but also why might Trump win?
The why might Trump lose is all the stuff I just said. You know, America, it actually turns out that Trump's erratic nature, Trump's scandals, Trump's instability, all of those things are not attractive to most Americans. So the entire time Trump has been either a candidate or a president or a candidate again, he's never been very popular at all. In 2016, when he won the election, he had the worst net favorability rating of any major politician in the United States. So a majority of Americans have always disliked him for all of the obvious reasons I just articulated. So that's his great weakness. He has a low ceiling in his support. That's his great weakness. His great strength, however, is he has a high floor in his support. So he has a low ceiling, but he has a very high floor. And by that, I mean, the people who do support him are utterly with him, are very loyal to him. And so he has a percentage of Americans in a Republican primary are totally dedicated to him. And then once the primary is over, he has a greater percentage of Americans who are totally dedicated to him when taking on a Democrat. And so he has this high floor. And so what that means is the Democrats become very vulnerable when they nominate somebody who is also unpopular. That's what they did with Hillary Clinton in 2016. The two politicians in America who had the lowest net favorability ratings were, drum roll please, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. So in many ways, the Democrats in 2016 nominated the only person who could have conceivably lost to Donald Trump, because she was the only Democratic politician with unfavorable ratings in that Trump arena, in that Trump world. And in 2020, when Joe Biden ran against him, it's not that Biden was overwhelmingly popular, but he was more popular than Donald Trump. He had the higher ceiling than Donald Trump. But the interesting thing about Biden, because he does not have a cult like Donald Trump has, he has a lower floor than Trump does. So Biden unquestionably has the highest ceiling of the two candidates. He can pull together a bigger coalition than Trump can. He did it in 2020. But he also has a lower floor. And he has the lower floor because Biden was not the product of zealous Democratic support. He was selected because he was the best available option to beat Donald Trump. He was the guy who could pull in the broadest coalition. But lots of members of that coalition don't like each other very much.
Yeah.
And so if he makes a decision that placates one and alienates another, I mean, the war in Gaza is a perfect example of the Biden dilemma. Trump has one message. He's just going to stand with Israel, doesn't care what Israel does. Israel could bulldoze Gaza for all he cares. Biden has this view that Israel has a right of self-defense and the human rights of Gazans should be respected. Both, that's my view. Israel absolutely has a right of self-defense, and it absolutely has obligations to protect the human rights of Gazans as much as possible, according to the requirements of law. And so when he supports Israel, part of his big democratic coalition is very happy with that. When he restrains Israel, but another part is very unhappy. When he restrains Israel, the further left parts of his base are pleased, and then the more moderate parts of his coalition are angry. And so there are ways in which Biden, unlike Trump, has impossible decisions to make. Whereas Trump can rely on having essentially a cult following. He can switch completely on TikTok. In 2020, he wrote an executive order trying to ban TikTok. In 2024, he's supporting TikTok.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter at all. Policy matters for Biden. It doesn't matter for Trump. Personality matters for Biden. It doesn't matter for Trump. Honesty matters for Biden. It doesn't matter for Trump. And so you can start to see how Joe Biden can lose. It's that lower floor that he has.
Yeah, the enthusiasm gap.
And how can Joe Biden win? He's got the higher ceiling.
And yeah, so it's interesting, like you're talking about that gathering a coalition, because it's also a coalition that gathers itself, the anti-MAGA coalition.
Yeah.
I guess leading into the next question, it's part of the reason that he can win as well, isn't it? That even if the enthusiasm is low, the anti-Trump enthusiasm remains very high. So let's kind of get to Biden now. Obviously with him, age has been an ongoing factor, and regardless of his kind of performance and his accomplishments, they just don't seem to cut through in any sort of meaningful way from what I can tell. So yeah, why don't you talk about Biden? Why might he lose? Why might he win? Obviously you've covered a little bit of that, but any other points you want to add?
Age is his huge weakness. His record is his great strength. The age issue has to be talked about, and it's become a very difficult thing to talk about sensibly in America right now, because a normal person with normal sensibilities knows that 81 is really old for any job, for any job. If you see someone who is stocking shelves at Walmart or Costco, these are big box retail stores. So someone stocking stores and shelves in a big box retail store and they're 81, you would say, why are you doing this? If the manager of the store was 81, you would say, why aren't you retired? You know, and he's in his 80s. And by the time he finishes his second term, he'd be 86 years old. And we all know that the effects of age are cumulative. At a certain point, you can kind of say, today is the best day physically of the rest of my life. And you can't then yell at Americans and say, stop talking about this, when everyone has an older relative, or perhaps you're older yourself, and you know what age does. And so it's very counterproductive, I think, for Democrats to yell at Americans about the age issue. What you need to do is get Joe Biden out there and say, however old he is, he's more sharp than Donald Trump. However old he is, his policies are better than Donald Trump. That's what you have to do. Just hit it and be relentless about it. And so that's a huge weakness for him. And two-thirds or, you know, overwhelming percentage of Americans think both of these candidates are too old or infirm to be president. His strength is one that, sadly enough, in the current moment that is driven so much by what's called negative partisanship, which means I support my candidate not because I love what they do so much as because I hate what the other guy is.
Yeah.
And so actually political records don't seem to matter as much as they used to, but he's able to run on a record that says a few things. One, my opponent presided over one of the largest increases of crime in American history, murder specifically. I have presided over one of the largest decreases in crime in American history. Violent crime is the lowest it's been in 50 years in the United States. My opponent botched COVID to such an extent that I inherited an economic disaster, and now the American economy is the envy of the world. We've had too much inflation, certainly. I don't think you can just talk about the economy without mentioning inflation. But again, unemployment is low. Inflation is coming back under control. The net worth of the median American household has increased by a substantial amount during the Biden presidency. And then in international affairs, he's the one who can make the Reagan-style case to the American people. He says, I stood with Ukraine. That's what I did. To me, the Ukraine issue is the number one issue in the election. It is the most important issue in the election. And there is no number two that is very close to it, because this is a world historic moment between the confrontation between authoritarianism and liberal democracy, and is really going to determine how dangerous is the world going to be in the next many years. And he's on the wrong side of that. He's on the weak side of that. And so I think Biden just needs to hammer him for his weakness on this. Just hammer him. Because one thing we know from Cold War era American politics, the weaker, the candidate that was perceived as weaker consistently got beaten badly. Hmm. Consistently. To the point where after Jimmy Carter's presidency, where he lost in large part because he was perceived as being weak and standing up to the Soviet Union, the American people did not give the White House back to a Democrat until the end of the Cold War. That was 12 years after Carter, that was a Republican White House. So I think the answer is Biden's got to hammer him on his weakness. He's got to sell himself. He's got to sell this story of lower crime, American prosperity, American strength, American leadership, and then contrast that with Trump.
Yeah, so one of the things that's probably a bit perplexing for many of us, particularly outside the US, is this fatalistic rematch that's happening. Was there really no one else that could have stepped up? It feels like a bit of a failure of the imagination from both Democrats and maybe like old guard Republicans as well, who secretly don't like Trump but wouldn't admit it in public. So why wasn't there a third party formed, in your opinion? And why seemingly didn't the Democrats take the primary process more seriously and put forward some new candidates?
Okay, so both of these are actually really easy answers. Why is there no third party? Because the American system is stacked against creating viable third parties. We have such a very long history of a two-party system, something that, you know, many, many, many other advanced liberal democracies, they have multiple parties. Great Britain, for example, multiple, you know, that has two major parties, but the other parties matter. They really do matter. You see coalition governments across the Western world where multiple parties are in the process and they form these coalition governments. But the American system, we've had these two parties. It's been Republicans and Democrats since the Republicans essentially destroyed the Whig Party in the run-up to the Civil War. And it's just very, very difficult. In my lifetime, we've had really two serious third party attempts. One completely flamed out in 80 when John Anderson was a third option to Reagan and Carter. And there was some buzz that he might do something in the election. He flamed out. And then Ross Perot in 1992 took on, you know, roughly around 20% of the vote, which was the best third party showing. But that was a very unique circumstance because you had a mega billionaire who was very famous before he entered politics. In the United States, sometimes it just takes a big personality to draw people's eyes away from the third party. But the system is very difficult culturally, legally, systematically for a third party to emerge in the U.S. I think we need one. I think we need four parties, a far left, center right, far right party. But that's not in the cards anytime soon. And then the answer for the Democrats is real simple. As soon as Joe Biden decided he wanted to run again, they had no good options. Because if you're a party strategist, there's one thing you know about modern American primaries, and that is every time a sitting president has faced a serious primary challenger in the last 50 years or so, that party's presidential candidate has lost the general election. 76, when Reagan challenged Ford, Ford lost in the general. In 80, when Kennedy challenged Carter, Carter lost. And in 92, when Patrick Buchanan challenged George H.W. Bush, H.W. Bush lost. These primary challenges of incumbents tend to fracture parties. And so when Biden decided to run, in many ways, that made the decision for the Democrats because they weren't willing to go through. And now Dean Phillips, but that was not ever a serious challenge. But they knew that a serious challenge could fracture the party. And so quite literally, it was up to Joe Biden. As far as Republicans, it's a different deal. You can't blame the Republican Party. You can't blame Republican politicians for not creating alternatives because a bunch of people stepped up. Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Ron DeSantis, you know, Republicans, that's who to blame. the rank and file Republican primary voters because they want themselves some more Donald Trump. And on the Republican side, there is a lot of blame for establishment Republicans covering for Trump. But the bottom line for the Republican Party is there's no one to blame but Republican voters. That's the bottom line. And you can't blame McConnell. You can't blame any Republican voters are getting the man that they want, period, end of discussion.
Yeah, that's sobering.
Yes.
So in this pinch at the moment, the U.S. could take a long time to recover. What do you think is needed to lower the temperature of the political climate and the political process?
Well, one thing, I hate to sound this simplistic, but Donald Trump has to lose. I think that there are massive cultural ramifications of another Donald Trump victory, and there are significant and hopefully massive, but in the opposite direction, cultural ramifications of a Donald Trump loss. If Trump wins, this is the model for Republicans. He's already the model, but it is a model that will endure for a generation, that he will have been defeated once, indicted, found responsible for sexual assault, found liable for fraud, and still wins. There are Republicans who will believe that that is quite literally an act of divine providence. The loyalty to him in that circumstance will be, if you think it's tough to fathom how intense it is now, just wait, my friend. If he comes back in, then the message to the GOP is going to be, it's not just that Donald Trump is who we need to be behind. It is that Trumpism, the imitation of Donald Trump, is the path to victory. And so just be ready for the extinction of anything like Reagan conservatism, traditional Republicanism. The Mitt Romneys of the party will forever be banished, or at least for a generation. Whereas if he loses, there is a chance that you at least have an opportunity for people to come to their senses. But I'm honestly of the opinion that the real necessity is a heart change. The support for Trump is driven by an enormous amount of rage and anger and fear. And it's driven, sadly, this makes me very sad as a Christian. It's driven by an enormous amount of Christian rage, anger, and fear. And so there has got to be, you know, I'm going to use a religious word. There has to be repentance, in my view. I'm not saying that, you know, Republicans take out some sort of full page ad, we're sorry, or whatever. That's ridiculously unrealistic. At scale, people having a change of heart, tacking away from the misery that we're in that is driven by rage and towards the unity that we can experience with much more grace.
Yeah, that connects really nicely with the next question I have for you. Just one of the things that I love about your articles and your general demeanor and like temperament and tone is that you are genuinely trying to change hearts and minds through tools of persuasion and congeniality, charity, these sorts of things. And you have an important and globally recognized platform at New York Times, but you're also trying to do it at a grassroots level and with local churches. So
right.
I just want to ask you about the after party that you started a little while back. Mm-hmm. Could you share what you guys are trying to do with that?
Yeah. You know, and this is actually something that it's the after party is a curriculum on Christian political engagement. And it is not, in many ways, it's not American specific, actually, because the actual emphasis of the curriculum is that for years and years and years and years in the United States, I don't know how it is in Australia, but in the United States, the emphasis on teaching Christians how to engage in politics is focused on issues. Christians should be pro-life. Christians should be for religious freedom. Christians should have this view of immigration or this view of civil rights. And it's all been focused on policies. It is not focused on practices or conduct, right? And so what has ended up happening is that Christians have begun to adopt thoroughly unbiblical approaches to politics that they rationalize by their pursuing. They've begun to take an ends justifies the means approach. That is, okay, so long as you're pro-life or so long as you support religious liberty, then it's almost like that pro-life stance and that religious liberty baptizes all of your lying and corruption. If I'm lying for life, if I'm corrupt for liberty, no, that is not how it works. And so what the after party is trying to do is to show Christians that actually Scripture has a lot more to say about how we are to engage in the public square than it has to say about which policies we're to pursue in the public square. The New Testament is not a party platform. It doesn't have much to say about tax rates. It doesn't have much to say about military aid for Ukraine. And by saying not much, it has nothing to say about these kinds of things. But it has a lot to say about how we're to behave. And so there's a couple of verses that are sort of really pivotal. One in particular is Micah 6:8. This is an Old Testament verse, and it says, "What does the Lord require of you, O man, what is good?" And the verse says, "To act justly, to love mercy," some translations say kindness, "to act justly, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with the Lord your God." And so what we are arguing is that a lot of people who are engaged in politics have that first prong down, man. They are all about justice. They will tell you everything that you need to know about their policy positions. But they're devoid of kindness, and they have zero humility. Mm. But for the Christian, none of those three prongs are optional. Yes, you have to pursue justice. That's why you can't withdraw from politics. Justice, politics is in many ways how we achieve justice. But you pursue justice with kindness and humility. And what Christians have forgotten are those latter two values. And the absence of those values is ripping our country apart. Another way to put it is, if you go to the book of Galatians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul articulates, really, how are you to know, you know, what is the fruit of the Spirit? How do you know that the Holy Spirit is at work in someone's life? And the answer is not by a set of political positions or even theological positions. The answer is a set of virtues: kindness, peace, patience, gentleness, self-control. That's the fruit of the Spirit. And what I ask Christians all the time around the country is, watch the Christians who are engaged in politics right now. How much kindness, peace, patience, gentleness, joy, self-control are you seeing? And the answer is, with some exceptions, the answer is virtually none. Instead, you're seeing anger, division, strife, envy, etc. So what we're trying to do is to teach a Christian public that Scripture itself says you can never believe that the ends justify the means. And in fact, Scripture itself prohibits your hostility against your political opponents. It says, love your enemies, bless those who persecute you. And those characteristics are not found in most Christian political engagement. And so our after-party curriculum is about how, it's not just about how are we to behave, it's about how do we change our hearts to get there. Mm-hmm. And we talk about how we're all prone to negative, different aspects of negative engagement. So for me, I talked earlier in our podcast that I'm prone to being combative. And so my temptation has always been to be too aggressive. And part of what it means to grow as a Christian is to rein in that combativeness without losing the quest for justice. Some people they're very cynical. You know, they feel like they know what's right, but they're not going to engage because they have no hope. And so, you know, no, actually we want to increase the amount of hope in people so that they'll feel that they can engage. And so we're talking about not just how we should behave in the public square, but how do we get our hearts in that place?
Love it. That speaks my language. And yeah, really appreciative that you do that stuff. So I'll be really interested to hear how it goes over the next few years. Hopefully it does some powerful work.
As you might imagine, it's already quite contentious because
yes.
The curriculum, even though we do not tell people who to vote for, and we say you can be a Christian and be a Republican, you can be a Christian and be a Democrat, but all Christians should have that fruit of the Spirit in their interactions with each other and with the world. A lot of people don't want that message. They do not want that message because they say that kindness equals surrender. And that's just wrong. Or that kindness is weak. No, kindness takes courage. It takes real courage to be kind in a cruel era.
Yeah.
And so there's just an enormous blowback already building because people want the anger. They want the rage. And then when they're told that that anger and rage is not just counterproductive, but actually in many cases immoral, they react with even more anger and rage.
Yeah, against David French's in part two.
Right.
Well, you spoke there of courage, and we'll go to our final question here. So for those who follow your work, many will know of your dear wife Nancy's recent cancer diagnosis. You wrote a really beautiful and touching article talking about being part of a community that shares the burden with you guys. So adding this layer on top of everything else that we've talked about, I just wanted to ask you, how do you find peace with all of this as a backdrop? What do you find calibrates you when the world is spinning?
Yeah. So first, I think it's really important to be honest and not to say that you're more peaceful than you are. So I've seen public figures, Christian public figures, talk about their adversity. And a lot of times I feel like they project more peace than they actually feel because they're expected to project peace. Let me say this. Cancer's scary. It's scary. It's horrible. And we can want to feel peaceful, and instead you will find that you feel incredible anxiety. And so I think there's a couple of things here. One is have grace for yourself, and that hard things are hard, and you should not feel bad, guilty, or whatever at feeling the incredible weight of adversity. To feel that weight is not to lack faith. To feel that anxiety is not to lack faith. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus felt weight and anxiety. You know, he didn't go walk into crucifixion like, God's got me, y'all. It was tough. It was tough. And so I think acknowledging the difficulty, acknowledging the reality of the difficulty is really important. And also by doing that, it can be a gift to another person because it can actually be oppressive to somebody else if you are projecting a false sense of calm and peace, and they don't feel that in their situation, they'll look at you and say, why are you feeling like that and I can't? And so I'm just going to tell you, and I'll be honest, it's hard and it's scary, but I think that faith is not necessarily the same thing as being calm in the face of that hard, scary thing. But I think faith is one thing that really helps us walk that next step, to take that next step. And then the other thing you will find when you are walking in faith through these steps is sometimes you'll encounter surprising bouts of peace. You'll encounter surprising bouts of reassurance. And then the other thing is you'll sometimes encounter overwhelming love. And that's been our experience. We have encountered overwhelming love. And I wrote this piece that you talked about to essentially pay tribute to the people who've poured themselves into our lives. And the centerpiece of the piece was this Swedish proverb that I think is beautiful. And this is like a guide. This Swedish proverb is sort of like a mission statement for us all in some ways. And that proverb is, shared joy is double joy. Shared sorrow is half sorrow. And what we found is when my wife shared her diagnosis, the people pouring into our lives with love and affection and very real help, actually, just in a few minutes, somebody's going to be delivering a meal to our house. That very real help diminished the sorrow. It diminished the pain. And so what I would say is one way to diminish pain is to help people. And by doing that, by extending yourself for somebody else, you're going to ease their burden. You're going to ease their burden, and it won't be entirely their burden anymore. And I think that that's a very, very important thing. And that I would say the one thing that has surprised me and provided us more peace than I thought it would was the love of friends, the love of my church, the love of strangers. Nancy, my wife, that has been very life-giving to her. But I don't want to minimize the anxiety or the sadness or the scariness of it all, because I want people to know there isn't a magic trick to get out of that. It's a hard walk, no matter what.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful note to end on. Obviously, it's going to be a big year for you at a personal level, but yeah, a big year for the globe in many ways. So I wanted to thank you, David, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you on Deeper Questions.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I hope you found that to be a helpful primer for what will no doubt be a bruising, unpredictable, emotionally charged, far-reaching, far-fetched, farcical, and combustible US election. With hyperpolarization such a feature of modern politics, plus the lightning rod that Trump is, it is impossible to be neutral. That's not to say that people can't bring a level of objectivity, but neutrality is impossible, which makes my closing reflection extra hard for this episode. So I'm not going to pretend to be a neutral, passive observer, but to hopefully share some thoughtful reflection. I'll also just say that it's not some bland form of centrism I'm advocating when it comes to this election. And it's definitely not both sidesism, where both parties are essentially as bad as each other. There are clear differences that ought to shape the way you think about this precipitous moment. There was a New Yorker article by John Cassidy in late 2020 titled, "The GOP Can No Longer Be Relied On to Protect Democracy." And he's referring to the way that the Republican Party, and specifically the elected Republican Congress members, embraced the big lie that the 2020 US election was rigged, stolen, and fraudulent. Despite producing zero evidence and every court in the land, including courts where Donald Trump appointed the judges, like the Supreme Court, they smacked down these claims case after case after case. And this article by Cassidy, it's always stuck with me, because our appointed leaders are supposed to be the guardians and custodians of democracy. But it's become clear since the emergence of Donald Trump that only one party remains committed to the ideas and values of democracy, while the other is committed to one man and his whims. Completely different parties, completely different values, completely different ideas of freedom, and completely different futures. Alexis de Tocqueville, in his classic Democracy in America, writes that without common ideas, there is no common action. And without common action, men still exist, but a social body does not. Thus, in order that there be society and all the more that this society prosper, it is necessary that all the minds of the citizens always be brought together and held together by some principal ideas. And I think it's pretty undeniable that democratic ideas and systems have been central to the prosperous societies and nations over the last few centuries. We have so many freedoms. Freedom to speak, to gather, to protest, to associate, to move, to believe, to be. We have checks, balances, laws and processes to hold the powerful to account when they abuse their power. We have leaders who willingly give up their power based on the will of the people, without bloodshed and without chaos. It's not a perfect system, and no system can be when we're dealing with the human propensity to scheme, deceive and destroy good things, but it's the best system we've come up with, and it cultivates a posture of humility and seeing fellow man with dignity. And for me as a Christian, it fits like a glove into the kind of world I want to live in. Christianity has no doubt played a massive part in the formation and cultivation of democracies around the world. And yet, we can't take democracy for granted. Amongst the sweep of human history, they are an anomaly when it comes to civilization and rulers. There are bad actors and nihilistic and opportunistic politicians that want to upend these ideas and return to archaic and corrupt forms of holding power. And they're no longer on the fringes either, but at the top of the YouTube and podcast charts, being invited on talk shows, speaking on the stages at popular conventions, and lastly, running and winning seats in elections. At one of the Conservative Political Action conferences earlier this year, CPAC, in Washington, D.C., provocateur Jack Posobiec warmed the crowd with a different kind of welcome to country. He said, "Welcome to the end of democracy. We're here to overthrow it completely. We didn't get all the way there on January 6th, but we will endeavour to get rid of it." And he is but one of many voices, openly pouring gasoline on everything that's been built. And it's important that we take them at their word and not allow them to hand out matches to unsuspecting accomplices. Once you lose a democracy, it's very hard to get it back and to enjoy the freedoms that we take for granted every day in a country like Australia. And so I urge you to approach elections with care. There's a saying David French has used often before, and I think it's so helpful for politics and for much of life, really. He says, "Character is destiny," which I believe came from the ancient Greek philosophers. Character is destiny. And if you vote for cruel, vindictive, and unscrupulous people, you'll get cruel, vindictive, and unscrupulous policies. But even more than that, we inevitably become like our leaders. And Donald Trump is not a man of character. We all know this. I mean, compare him with the central figure and ideas of Christianity, as unfair as that is. Jesus says to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. He comes not to serve, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. He says, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." Rather than vengeance, well, mercy and grace are the values of Jesus' movement. And that's the kind of character worth following. Now, it's obviously unfair to compare political figures to Jesus, but they ought to be people of high character who feel the burden and privilege that comes with public service. Not those with a lust for power, those who lie, cheat and steal to get there and bring out the worst in us once they're in. It's not surprising that people tune out when these are the kinds of people naturally attracted to politics. There's a proverb in the Bible that says, "The more knowledge, the more sorrow." And I contemplate this all the time when I read about the state of the world and all the things that are going wrong. It's a gift to be able to tune it out, to focus on things and people you love. And so it's something I try and do when I can feel my mental health slipping, just returning to the things that bring me life and vibrance and joy. But at the same time, those with bad intentions are counting on us not to engage, to approach elections on vibe rather than virtue, and to sleepwalk them into power. And so I want to encourage a better vision for politics, a return to common ideas and values and hopes, because I know I'd rather approach elections with excitement rather than existential dread, and I'm sure you would too. And things can get better when we do the hard work of nation building together in all of its complexity, when we immerse ourselves in positive communities that not only seek the common good, but are willing to love our enemies too, when we see all with dignity and equality and a right to exist alongside us. So wherever you're at, and whichever communities you're part of, democracies survive through persuasion and action, showing again and again that our freedom brings fruit and our ideas can change the world for the better. People can change their mind and good things are possible. Speaking of good things, since our chat, David's wife Nancy has been undergoing lots of different treatments for her cancer, including radiation, chemotherapy and surgery. And as of recording this, so late June 2024, I saw that Nancy's doctor had given an update that her cancer has completely disappeared, even at a microscopic level. So I recommend following both of them on social media to partake in a small way in their double joy. And if you're a praying type, it's one of those things to thank God for. And keep praying for others in your life going through similar trials. But also pray for our elections, our countries, our leaders, our governments, as Scripture asks us to do. They need our prayers as much as we do, if not more. And look, I don't know if democracy will survive long term. Like we shared in the intro, it's under assault in a way that I haven't really seen before in my few years. But like with the people we love and life itself, it's something to be cherished, something to fight for, something to give our best and our all to, knowing that God can help us through the precipitous moments, even when we feel disillusioned, even when we feel hopeless, even when we feel like giving up. And as a Christian, I know that for me, I have tools available to find hope where others can't, and that Jesus' resurrection and promises of the redemption of all things can sustain me. But it also helps me to keep going now. I don't want to be naive about the uncertainty and pain of this world, but I think my faith helps me to embrace the moments of sorrow, knowing that it'll be worth it in the end. And I want to invite you to explore this hope with us. It's a different hope to Christian nationalism and this form of political evangelicalism that has swept through America. And I hope you'll stick around for more of these conversations as we attempt to submerge in wonder and surface with hope together. Stay tuned for more deeper questions. Do all that normal stuff like subscribing for more, leaving us a review and sharing it with your friends if you found this helpful. Reach out with questions. We'd love to hear from you. And check out the show notes for some of the stuff that we've talked about. I'm your host, Aaron Johnstone. And until next time, this has been Deeper Questions. Submerge in wonder, surface with hope.